Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 16th of October, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire. Welcome back to the programme, Patrick.
Great to be with you, Mike.
And also, Brian Gerrish. Welcome to the programme, Brian, from elsewhere at the moment.
From elsewhere. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, okay. Okay, well, look, we're going to get straight on with Brexit, sadly. And Leo Varadkar, he was quite optimistic this morning. I think we're making progress, but there are issues yet to be resolved, and hopefully that can be done today, is what he said. But it is not. If it's not, sorry, there'll be more time. October 31st, still a few weeks away, and there's the potential of an additional summit before that, if we need one. Although time is running short, I'm confident that Ireland's objectives can be met. Now, there was all kinds of stuff in the press this morning, and as usual, we've got to give it largely a great ignoring, because this is all the usual type of stuff that happens when you're running up against a deadline on a negotiation like this. So we had things like people walking out of negotiations and so on. No discussion, Patrick, about whether they walked back into the negotiations, whether they'd just gone for a rest break or to the loo or something like that. It was being presented by the mainstream press as if it was something really serious. But in the meantime, we have Stephen Barclay here, who was giving evidence in front of the Department for Exiting the EU committee. And he was saying that the UK and the EU are working on a revised political declaration. Now, this is really important, because, of course, most of the stuff which the political declaration is all about the future relationship with the EU post the divorce, whatever kind of divorce we have. A large segment of that, of the currently existing political declaration, is all about defence and our defence relationship. So, Brian, I'd just be interested in your thoughts on this. This is quite an interesting development. If he's saying that the UK and the EU are working on a revised political declaration, then there's the opportunity perhaps to revise any obligations that there are with respect to defence, although that hasn't been specifically mentioned.
No, Mike, this is an incredible thing, isn't it, that we still haven't seen any proper press coverage, media coverage of EU Defence Union. Nobody wants to talk about it. The Express newspaper covered it briefly. Lord James spoke about it in the House of Lords. He was then warned off. We've got some of the veterans who stood up and spoken about it. And of course, our own David Ellis has been warning about it for months. But we just do not see it talked about as a topic. And we know that our Defence Minister Ben Wallace is well aware, but he doesn't quite understand it. He said he had to speak to a lawyer in order to understand what's happening. So the public doesn't know what's taking place with regard to the EU, sorry, to UK being in EU Defence Union. Ben Wallace doesn't know. Perhaps now's the time that this subject is brought to the fore, as you say.
Absolutely. Now, the committee that was questioning the Department for Exiting the EU committee this morning had this man, Mr. Ben, Hilary Benn, asking many of the questions. And actually, some of his committee colleagues were demanding that he resigns this morning, because he's chair of the Department for Exiting the EU committee. And he was basically hogging the whole show this morning. So they were questioning Steve Barclay on the situation with negotiations over Brexit. 20 minutes in, nobody else on the committee had been given any opportunity to ask any questions. He was basically asked to resign. He not only didn't resign, but he just continued hogging the time. Really, the conflict of interest there being because, of course, it was his bill which requires Boris Johnson to ask for an extension this weekend if a deal is not done today and agreed during the European Council meeting, which takes place tomorrow on Friday. Brian will be talking about this in 1 second. But this is Sebastian Payne, who's a Financial Times journalist, tweeting this out this morning. Huge new ComRes survey of 26,000 Britons concludes folks still want Brexit delivered. As I say, Brian will be going into this in a little bit more detail later on. But what's interesting is that in the other mainstream coverage of this, there was no mention of the scale of this this survey, because normally surveys are done with 1,000 or a couple of thousand people, 26,000 people, and they're saying 54% support abiding by the referendum result and leaving the EU. I suspect that's being downplayed a little bit in the mainstream press because it's not quite the result that they were hoping for. And just briefly, I'll just mention this, that, you know, the idea that people are so jaded by Brexit that they're being turned off from the mainstream news is being highlighted by Sky here, saying that they're going to start today at 5 p.m. a new pop-up, what they're describing as a pop-up news channel. It's going to be transmitting between 5 and 10 p.m. each weekday, which is going to produce news which is, they're saying, Brexit free. So for whatever reason, they think that there is a market in Brexit free news. I think, again, they're completely missing the point.
BTD, it's a Brexit traumatic disorder, is afflicting quite a few people, especially mainstream news consumers. But isn't it funny, Mike, that the most important issue facing the country, maybe in centuries, and some of the major media outlets in the country are wanting to just completely expunge it from the news cycle. I find that quite interesting. There's a lot of theories that you could posit as to why they're doing this right now.
Absolutely. Brian, just getting back to the survey, this was the front page of the BBC News website this morning. Brexit talks enter last day. But underneath that, under a nice little picture of a union flag with the EU flag underneath it, they're talking about this issue of the survey. So we can zoom that in there. So what's this all about then?
Well, Mike, this is just a fascinating little article and encourage people to go and have a look at it. I saw it there. It's in a very prominent position. We get into it. And what it starts to do is show us who's controlling the narrative. So let's talk through a bit how this thing has been put together. So if we pop on to the next slide here, and you might have to help me out with a little bit of this. Glasses definitely need to go on today. What have we got here? Well, we've got a carefully crafted article. So it opens with the original referendum result, quite rightly saying that 52% voted leave, but that is in very small text. And after that, everything in this article is done in headlines. So we've got a subheadline, they're talking about there's no majority, and that is misleading itself. We've got the policy of drawing the reader into a number of graphs asking which solutions you favour, and those options include remain and also holding a second referendum. And what I detect is going on here is that people are being drawn into this. This BBC article is designed to be creating confusion. It's pulling people away from the idea of Brexit. So let me just go on through. It's got a subheadline, subheadline, leave and remain voters hold very different views. Well, that's a pretty interesting statement, because if you voted leave, you're going to have a different view to somebody who's voting remain. And that's pretty clear, but the BBC needs to tell us that. And then we've got another subheadline, voters are split on holding another referendum. And then finally, in the article, voters are divided about whether any agreement that might be reached with the EU should be put to a referendum. But they agree that those who voted remain are much keener on another vote than those who back leave. So those who voted remain are much more likely than those who voted leave to welcome a ballot that might overturn the result of 3 years ago. This is just talking word salad, I think is your favourite phrase here, Mike, because it's giving us obvious statements, but mixing all this up. If I can just follow through, if we go on to the next slide, where does this lot come from? Well, when you get to the end of the article, you're actually looking at this man, Sir John Curtis, and what are they saying? The analysis was commissioned by the BBC from an expert working for an outside organisation. Now, this is to say that essentially this is independent and unbiased. But where's this gentleman come from? Well, he's working with Strathclyde University, and he's also there a fellow at the National Centre for Social Research and the UK in a Changing Europe. And this is where the story starts. So let's follow it through very quickly. And here we've got UK in a Changing Europe. And what are they saying to us? We've studied Brexit so that you don't have to. You mentioned about the media turning off news about Brexit. This fits, as far as I can see, because they don't want us to do the analysis. They've done it for us. So there is the gentleman himself, Sir Clive Curtis, and he's saying we provide evidence. There's no bias, no bullshit. This is all statements in this little video clip from their website. Goodbye to biased Brexit. We prioritise the truth above all else, deploying the facts and discarding the fiction. So this is absolutely coming on to this bit that you don't have to do any research yourself because they've done it. So that's one organisation he's involved in. And this is the second one. And I really encourage people to go and have a look at this. This is the National Centre for Social Research. And we've got Guy Goodwin, who's the chief executive. But if you go into his background, he was working as UK director of society statistics for the European Union. And if you have a look at that organisation and what they're doing, well, of course, it's collecting statistics from everywhere to help the European Union. So we might ask a few questions about how unbiased this gentleman is. But if you look for the blue arrow, what I'm pointing out is the European Statistical System, Eurostat, is boasting that it's also collecting statistics for the European Central Bank. So BBC tells us to trust the information that they're putting up on screen. But as you delve into it, it just seems to get more woolly. And if I then take people in a slightly different direction here, this is one of the reports that they've produced. And what they're saying is that they've been continually researching British social attitudes. And in 2016-17, people were apparently wanted greater state intervention and higher taxes. And although there was an increase in liberal attitudes towards people's private lives, they were wanted a tougher law and order and terrorism policy. And so the organisation is boasting here, we use the mass media to promote the findings to the public. So what we've got is a circular argument going on here, that you've got companies which are going out there and conducting surveys, but actually they've been providing information back through to the government, which is changing people's opinions. And the same can be said of Sir Clive himself, because I've taken a quick excerpt here, which you can just pop up on the screen. A cursory search shows that this man is politically active himself. He's commenting on politics. He's using his survey information sometimes. Sometimes he's talking about what's happening. And the net result is, if I go to the final slide, you can see that basically you've got a circulation of information. You've got the government in the centre, which is providing money, 200 million to the Economic and Social Research Council. They're putting it into these research companies and the universities who are producing data. The data's released back into the public. Public opinion changes, and that's used to change policy. And what I've said here is that essentially what we're watching is participatory democracy at work. So this isn't the individual voter that's counting. You've got government-funded organisations are putting policy back through and into the system. So this is a very devious system, which the average person has no idea what's happening.
And yeah, and just to clarify this, Brian, of course, when you use that term participatory democracy, many people view that in a particular way. They see it as a good thing because they see it as something that needs to be encouraged, people getting involved, participating in democratic processes and so on. But in fact, that what we're labeling participatory democracy, what they're labeling participatory democracy, excludes individuals. Because it'll be the non-governmental organizations, the think tanks, academics, and others that are actually allowed to participate. Everybody else's views are excluded.
That's absolutely correct, Mike. And so we're seeing the individual voter is pushed to one side. You're the little voter, you're the little person, you don't need to know. We're not even going to bother to cover Brexit because we think you're a bit stressed out. We're going to take it out of the media. The BBC promoting organisations who actually say on their website, you don't need to know yourselves because we know. And this is unbelievably dangerous stuff.
Okay, now we're going to come on to the situation in Syria in 1 minute. But just before we do that, I wanted to get your views briefly on this, Brian, because we've got a new Twitter account set up. It's the Office for Veterans Affairs. It's at veterans.gov.uk. They joined in October 2019. They apparently are ensuring the United Kingdom leads the world in care for armed forces veterans. And their first tweet had a nice little graphic saying, "Our ambition is to make the UK the best place in the world to be a veteran." Now, what interests me, I'm absolutely in support of support for veterans because they need it. In the UK and the United States, our veterans have been treated extremely badly by our governments up until this point. And so what interests me here, Brian, is the timing of this. Why now? And they've set up this organisation. It's going to be within the Cabinet Office. Johnny Mercer is involved in it. So as being right in the middle of the Cabinet Office, it's clearly a high priority from a policy point of view. So the question then is, again, why now? And it seems to me, Brian, that it's because veterans are increasingly finding a voice in this country and they're managing to get their message out on a broad basis. But I have to say, this is actually quite dangerous because we're already seeing some veterans pulling back from their positions as this office has been established.
Well, Mike, I'm going to say I hope that the veterans out there are going to be bright enough to see through this scam. I'm sure they are. I think the government is deeply worried that veterans have now started to pick up on the fact that the UK's military has been sold out to EU Defence Union. That's the big hidden secret across parties. They're now speaking out about it. What does the government need? Well, it needs a control mechanism to keep the veterans quiet. And I'm sure that this is exactly why this has been set up. And I think it's significant that it's working from within the Cabinet Office, because, of course, that is the dark heart of government. And what is the job of that organisation going to be? To placate, to keep a lid on pressure from military veterans to say what is going on in this country. Mm. And yes, we know that individual veterans have been pressurised at quite high level after they've started to ask the questions about why Britain's military is being betrayed and why the public aren't being told the truth about what EU Defence Union means.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you for that. Now, Patrick, let's move on to Syria. So what have we got here? New York Times pullback begins. So what's the latest on this?
Well, as everyone who's been following the news knows quite well, the mainstream establishment is in complete meltdown after Donald Trump announced that he was pulling U.S. troops out of northeastern Syria over the last week. And this coincided with a Turkish invasion of northeastern Syria, ostensibly to stamp out the threat by Kurdish militias, YPG, PKK, according to the Turkish authorities, are terrorist and terrorist-linked organizations. And those are the main the main group and main bulk of the Syrian Democratic Forces, which had been backed by the United States. Needless to say, Mike, this is extremely complicated and a complex affair, and we'll try to show you a few important points to take away right now in this segment. But as a kind of retaliation, there's been a lot of pressure on Donald Trump. You'll see the president himself has now come under fire from both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans, for his move. And so he's applied sanctions, threatened sanctions against President Erdogan and Turkey for their, let's say, aggression in northeastern Syria, hitting U.S. allies or former U.S.-backed allies, the Kurdish, various Kurdish factions in northeastern Syria.
One thing I was going to ask you was, do you see this as Donald Trump finally putting his mark in the ground, saying no more with respect to the U.S. deep state and their sort of regime change operations?
I think what he is trying to do clearly is to make good on his campaign promises, which was to bring U.S. troops home, unnecessarily deployed troops in the Middle East, and to undo the so-called endless wars of the previous administrations. So coming into the 2020 election cycle, this is something clearly the president is wanting to do, make good on those promises to the American people, because that did so well to clear a path for him to the White House in 2016. I think he's hoping to replicate and to cultivate some of that goodwill that helped him win in 2016. The problem is the U.S. is tied into knots in terms of their involvement in Syria, both this involvement, this illegal occupation by U.S. troops in northeastern Syria, but also their backing of various proxies in Syria, effectively fighting a proxy war for the last 8 years. And I'll go through some of the details of that as well. I think what you're looking at here, Mike, and I know the next clip will illustrate this very well, the narrative in the United States and the Western press is that the U.S. needs to be there to prevent a Turkish massacre of the Kurds,
right,
or a Turkish genocide. You'll see this word has been used as well in mainstream media circles. So there's a potential genocide. And what we found from our research, Mike, and of course I just got back from the Middle East this past week on the ground from Beirut, and what I understood is this is completely overblown, this threat of a Kurdish genocide. And I think this is one of the fear tactics that's being used to try to keep U.S. assets into Syria, because the U.S. deep state does not want to relinquish all of its footholds in that country, but also to put pressure on President Trump. So you're right, there is a kind of a deep state, permanent state, security state, intelligence state versus Donald Trump's policy on this issue. That's clear.
Okay, well, we're going to have a little look at a piece of video now from ABC. Now, for people in the UK that maybe don't know, most people assume that CNN is the equivalent of the BBC. But so, where does ABC sit in the media picture in the United States?
Well, in terms of broadcast, traditional broadcast networks, ABC is one of the big three. So this would be the equivalent in the UK. You have the BBC, ITV, Channel 4. Those are your big three broadcasters traditionally on television. In America, it's ABC, CBS, NBC. Those are the traditional big three broadcasters in the United States. And then now you have the cable news networks, CNN, Fox, and a few others to make up that sort of elite mainstream media group.
Okay, so have a look at this. We've got a little clip here of two or three separate reports on the same issue from ABC. So have a look at this.
This video, obtained by ABC News, appears to show the fury of the Turkish attack on the border town of Tel Aviv,
a border town bombarded by Turkey's military.
This video right here appearing to show Turkey's military bombing Kurd civilians in a Syrian border town. The Kurds, who fought alongside the U.S.
Okay, so that couldn't really be clearer, Patrick. They are presenting that footage as being something which was taken in Syria, an attack on the Kurds by the Turks.
That feeds very nicely into the narrative of a Turkish massacre of the Kurds, right? It works. It's very effective, isn't it?
Absolutely. But unfortunately, ABC has been forced to apologize for that piece of video footage. which, as we just said, didn't appear in only one ABC report. It appeared in multiple ABC news reports, so they clearly had plenty of opportunity to verify it. They clearly haven't verified it. ABC apologizes for showing video from US gun range in report on Syria. How has this happened?
This is a good question, Mike. The big question is, who supplied the footage? Who is responsible for labeling that footage as coming from Syria, coming from the Turkish-Syrian border, and handing it to whoever was head producer at the news desk? And this is a major national network, so this isn't the sort of thing that you can just kind of make a mistake doing, we filed it in the wrong place. Mm. No, I believe this was intentional, and I believe that they weren't intending for this to be caught out. And I think really this was the public probably who probably brought this to the attention.
Yes, so it was a number of people on social media noted on Monday that the clip strongly resembled a video uploaded to YouTube in April 2017. The title Knob Creek Night Shoot 2017 referred to an evening machine gun event by the Knob Creek gun range in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And that has been confirmed now, so ABC has issued this apology. But it really shouldn't have happened in the first place.
Before social media, Mike, before people could trace videos, what would have happened when this report was aired after 20 years ago, 30 years ago? Would anything have happened? No.
No.
It would have probably gone in as historical record. And that begs the question, looking back in history, how much of the footage that we have seen to promote various wars and conflicts over the last 30, 40 years, 50 years, how much of it has been faked in the same way that this footage we've just shown you now was faked? Mm. This is a historical question. We're opening this conversation in the context up decades back. And I'm going to tell you, it's probably a lot more than people realize.
Mm. So in the meantime, you've been covering this on 21st Century Wire. Washington's sum of all fears, Kurdish militants cut a deal with Damascus.
Well, this is what people, I believe, are more angry about in the United States, in Western policy circles, U.S. congressmen, senators, British MPs. This is really what they're upset about here, is that the Kurdish factions have been forced to turn to Damascus, turn to Moscow, to negotiate some sort of security pact. Certainly this is something that Kurdish militants had to do, mm-hmm, in order to protect themselves, because they were being hit very hard by the Turkish military, but also by its various proxy militias that it's using on its front lines, many of whom formerly constituted the Free Syrian Army, who have been laying in wait over the Turkish border and waiting for this opportunity to raid Syria once again. This is the sum of all fears of Washington, because this is what they've invested all of their time and energy and money and military assets over the last few years, was to keep Damascus, mm-hmm, from having any relations with these Kurdish factions, because once this happens, there's no need for the United States to be there. Then Russia enters the picture. Then Damascus's allies enter the picture in the fight against ISIS and to secure its own borders along the Turkish and Syrian border. So this is the big fear of a united Syria. This is the thing that Washington has been trying to avoid. This is why they've been occupying northeastern Syria and allowing Syria, this is the really important part, Mike, to gain access to its oil and gas reserves in this section of the country. Mm. Because the oil and gas in Syria has been squatted and occupied by ISIS, who then handed it to the Kurdish SDF forces backed by the United States, keeping it out of the hands of the Syrian government, who've been unable to get affordable fuel, who've been unable to overcome an international embargo that's been strangling it economically because it can't even get its hands on its own energy resources. Mm. So this is why the United States is upset, because this part of the game is now coming to an end. And it'll be even worse when this area is settled and assets can be deployed also to take care of the Idlib province, mm, which will be maybe the last part of the country that's under terrorist or foreign occupation. So that, I encourage people to go to 21st Century Wire. There's a number of good analytical pieces that we've got up here that will explain this in very clear English. It's a very complex topic, and there's a lot of moving parts, but we hope that that will be helpful. Now, what is this leading to? Well, this was the news yesterday, Mike, and again, not a good day for the United States. Russia is working with the United States. Mm. Well, not a good day for the deep state, let's say.
Yes.
But a good day for general peace and stability, potentially. The U.S. is working with Russian forces, handing over former U.S. patrolling duties around the city of Manbij. And so they're liaising with the Russians. Can you believe this? So some U.S. special forces have stayed behind while they pull their troops out to help Russia be positioned as a buffer zone between the Turkish military and the Syrian Arab army, who are taking up secure positions. And this is an incredible story. And by the way, part of this deal that the Kurds have made with Damascus includes Kurdish factions, the SDF, being disbanded, and any remaining militias have to be integrated into the Syrian National Armed Forces of the Syrian Arab Republic.
Right.
So that's the end of the SDF. That's ostensibly the end of the Kurdish state-building project in Syria, Rojava, as it's called. So that's all kind of onto the side now. It's not on offer at the moment. So this is bad news for those who have attempted to create a Kurdish state within northern Syria that was, by a lot of people's estimations, totally unnatural, using an ethnic minority in northeastern Syria to create a new ethno-state.
Yeah.
Was essentially what the United States was planning to do. Whether they were actually serious about going through with it, Mike, I'm wondering now, looking at this recent news, have they used the Kurds again, as they have, and then dumped them at an opportune moment, as they have done in the past? Will the Kurdish factions ever learn their lesson?
But that must be Trump's hand there, because certainly Bolton would never have allowed that to happen while he was National Security Advisor, and this is something that the U.S. deep state has been fighting Trump on since he became elected. Trump has expressed on several occasions a desire to be working closer with Putin, and now he is.
In the war on terror.
Yes.
To defeat ISIS. It makes perfect sense. So why have we been avoiding this for so many years? Mm. And here we have the first motions in that direction. It's very encouraging. But I'm going to say it's very dangerous too, because there are a lot of there's a lot of chicanery going on behind the scenes, Mike, that would like to undermine some of these recent events over the last week.
Yeah.
So we shall see. But let's break this down for those who are confused about this issue. Let's take a look here. Now, there's double spin going on. The big bone of contention, one of the big bones of contention, is that ISIS prisoners have been let loose. Mm. Okay, here's the CFR. As Foreign Policy magazine saying, Turkish-backed forces are freeing Islamic State prisoners. And then you have claims by the president claiming that the Kurds have released ISIS prisoners on purpose. And if we look a little closer, this is CNN's fact check. Well, they're claiming that that President Trump is not telling the truth, Mike. But if you look into their article, you read, due to the attack by Kurdish forces on SDF in northern Syria, the Kurdish-led militias had to remove troops guarding prisons and camps holding ISIS fighters. Mm. So they're admitting that Trump is actually right here. But the Kurds have threatened to do this even before all this started, Mike. Mm. They use this as leverage to gain more U.S. support. So if you look at previous Kurdish threats to release ISIS prisoners, I'm going to say that there's no reason why they should have released these prisoners now. I think this really shows the true face of the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces that the U.S. and the U.K. have been supporting for a very long time now, so some 3 years now, in their illegal occupation of northeastern Syria. They can't hold territory. They can't keep their ISIS prisoners detained. So what is this group that we've been propping up? Mm. There was no chance of them ever being sustainable without an indefinite occupation, foreign Western occupation, an illegal occupation in northeastern Syria. That is the bottom line of this story. So let's look at what the problem is here. This is what we call a tale of two proxies here, Mike. Let's have a look here. And this is the tale of two proxies. First party is Turkey. Turkey has been using a proxy. United States has been using a proxy in Syria. Who is Turkey's proxy right now? Well, They're the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, as they were called. The problem with this group, in jihadist in character, formed by terrorists, effectively, and this is formerly U.S.-backed, arguably still U.S.-backed in some ways, but formerly U.S.-backed through the Train and Equip program, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars invested in what is effectively a terrorist organization, okay? Now, the U.S. have also been backing another proxy here, which is the SDF, which we mentioned before, the Syrian Democratic Forces, and they're made up of YPG, PKK. The PKK is a proscribed terrorist group by the United States, I believe by the UK and the EU as well. This is the Kurdistan Workers' Party, very much linked in too many ways with membership and so forth with the YPG, who make up the SDF, the bulk of the SDF. These are effectively, according to many people and Ankara and the Turkish authorities, as terrorists. Their ranks, Mike, are comprised also of former ISIS fighters. Okay, that's really important. So they're not all Kurdish. There are Arab militias, but there's hundreds, maybe more, maybe 1,000 ISIS fighters in the SDF. U.S.-backed, absolutely. So this is the tale of two proxies. What you're looking at here is what the media do not want you to focus on. That Erdogan's vanguard forces in his invasion was built by the United States government and with Turkish facilitation, and that the United States' vanguard there, the so-called Kurdish Defense Force, is actually has terrorist links and has ISIS members, have been burning villages. Even Amnesty International has accused them of war crimes. This is the SDF. This is the problem. And look what's happened. Well, it didn't take long, Mike, for the U.S. to start walking back their relationship with the SDF and Kurdish YPG. So apparently, according to the Washington Post, Mike, the Obama administration looked the other way and avoided putting the YPG on a terrorist list because they wanted to use them to create the Syrian Democratic Forces in 2015. This is coming out now. Okay, so you can label someone a terrorist or a freedom fighter, but the government, in this case, the United States government, backed off labeling this group as terrorist, even though quite clearly they're sharing membership with the PKK. Okay, why? Because they wanted to build the SDF to give the U.S. an excuse to occupy northeastern Syria. It's all coming out now. But it's interesting, Mike, because there's some British MPs who were talking about this on social media recently. Here's one. This is Lloyd Russell Moyle. He's a Labour and Co-op MP for Kempton and Peacehaven. This is down in the Brighton area, Brighton and Hove area. And this is what he tweeted out yesterday. He says, Turkey illegally invading puts a risk puts at risk the fight against ISIS, potentially freeing jihadis. We already covered the real story there. Endangered millions of Kurds and Arabs, whilst risking blowback in Turkey and Europe. Stop arms sales and military cooperation to Turkey. Support the SDF. That's a bit too late for that. I think they're being disbanded as we speak. And seek a resolution at the UN for NATO to have a no-fly zone. Over Turkey. This is the MP from Brighton, okay? So, no-fly zones. Mike, I didn't realize these were still in vogue in Westminster, NATO no-fly zones. What happened to the last NATO no-fly zone? It resulted in a failed state in Libya, which they're still suffering from today. So an interesting talking point there by the MP. We had a conversation on Twitter, actually, and these are just a few excerpts. If you want to look at the full thread, I do encourage people to go and watch that. And it didn't end there, Mike. He has said here, I don't know which analysis I was hoping for, but he's saying that he goes to regularly visit the SDF forces in Syria, into Rojava, as it was formerly called, and speaking to their commanders. That's where he gets his information. So this is why his analysis apparently is superior to others, is because he's on the ground with the SDF.
Illegally?
Well, this is an argument. Yeah, how did he get into the region? Probably over the Iraqi border, or flown in by some military transport from Turkey, or
he certainly didn't apply for a visa.
Probably from Iraq. Probably from the Iraq side. So in here he says, this is interesting. The YPG are not designated as a terrorist by the EU and the UK. This is technically correct because they are not. That's arguable. He says, I'm a proud supporter of the YPG. And the YPJ, PYD as it's called. So he's a proud supporter of these Kurdish militants, Mike. And already the U.S. is walking them back in terms of how they were. Now they're regretting creating this monster. So, but let me just remind people, if you have any questions about the authenticity of what we're saying, even the BBC themselves, Mike, have reported here. This is November 2017, Ryan Dalati and Quentin Somerville filed this report. The Kurdish SDF forces cleared the way in Raqqa for the Islamic State to escape. Okay, thousands of Islamic State fighters and their family members with weapons were allowed to escape because of the SDF proxies. Okay, mm-hmm. These are the ones that your MP from Brighton, the Labour MP from Brighton, is saying he is a proud supporter of. Mm-hmm. They not only have ISIS members in their ranks, they helped facilitate the escape of ISIS fighters from Raqqa right before it was about to be leveled by the U.S. Air Force. So that's very interesting. So what I'm saying, the bottom line here, Mike, is this is an incredibly complex story. There's no doubt about that. But I think if you read between the lines and you read a little bit closer in the reportage, you're going to find there's a lot more questions than answers with regards to the mainstream reporting of this issue right now. And I encourage people to check out alternative news sources that provide maybe slightly more in-depth analysis on this than you're getting in the mainstream right now.
Okay, now we're rapidly running out of time, but just briefly, if you like what the UK Column does and you would like to support us, your support would be much appreciated and much needed. Please head over to ukcolumn.org/community, where there are options for subscribing and memberships and so on there. And a quick reminder that this evening is the UK Column meeting in the George in Plimpton. Starts at 7:30 tonight. Patrick, we'll finish off with this one. A couple of weeks ago, we had Diljana Gunjeva on the program talking. Well, this is her new website, Arms Watch. Just remind us what she was discussing and give us a brief update.
Well, if you remember, this was back in September, on September 23rd broadcast of the UK Column. We revealed the story, U.S. weapons trafficking to terrorists, specifically ISIS, in Yemen. Okay, and this is a story which was filed by Bulgarian investigative journalist Diljana Gunjeva. Now, this is a story that has had an update, Mike, quite a serious update here. Diljana was given this information, these documents of U.S. weapons trafficking via Serbia through a whistleblower. That whistleblower was unmasked by, I believe, Serbian authorities, possibly with the help of a foreign intelligence service. We don't know for sure. It's still sketchy. But they have arrested the whistleblower who helped break this story. And he was immediately thrown in prison. And here's her tweeting out. She said, Serbian Interior Minister has arrested the whistleblower who leaked documents about the same Serbian minister's father, the U.S. government in Saudi Arabia, arming ISIS terrorists in the conflict in Yemen. Okay, so Krusk, the Serbian arms manufacturer, which was one of the suppliers of mortars to ISIS, has a link there with the Serbian interior minister. So It's a family connection. Potentially it's a national scandal, Mike. What they've done is attacked Diljana in the Serbian press and the Serbian political bodies to try to discredit her for this and attack the whistleblower himself, who, as it turns out, was an employee of the arms manufacturer. So this is an internal whistleblower. Okay.
Okay, so he ended up in prison, and Diljana then tweeted out that he was in prison, and something quite interesting happened.
So Diljana exactly tweeted out, and as you can see here, the public mobilized, Mike. Hundreds of people showed up to the prison demanding the release of this whistleblower. This was absolutely incredible. They've been out for three straight days demanding the release of this person. And the government has capitulated somewhat, has released him from prison and allowed him to remain in house arrest pending a hearing this coming week. Okay, so this is, story is still developing. Okay, but what's important here, Mike, is that the public did respond to De Liana's social media calls for justice on this. And this is potentially a national scandal, which the government seems to have avoided by attacking the whistleblower and attacking the journalist. Mm. Familiar theme, isn't it?
Absolutely.
We're seeing a lot of this sort of behavior by governments. It's not just what the West would consider, you know, fringe banana republic governments overseas. This same practice happens in the U.S. and the U.K. Specifically, we can cite the WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning, Jeremy Hammond, incarcerations and detentions. Same exact situation here, just on a slightly different scale. But what's interesting, Mike, is she's gotten some support from very, unusual places. Radio Free Europe, this is part of the United States National Board of Broadcasters, Governors, Broadcasters, mainly an overseas propaganda arm for the U.S. government, but occasionally does some good work, like NPR will occasionally break a story that's in the public interest. They've actually reported her story without changing anything, exactly as the statements which she gave to them. Mm. So they've given her a fair hearing, Radio Free Europe, on this. And she's saying, investigate the sale of weapons to terrorists. Don't arrest the whistleblower. That's the bottom line of the story. We'll have more from this hopefully next week, Mike, when the hearing comes on, and we'll see what the result's going to be for this whistleblower. And maybe we might be able to also get a statement from De Liana herself.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, De Liana, under a bit of pressure herself, because she's been criticized as not handling this whistleblower properly. But of course, what is never mentioned in this criticism is that the whistleblower didn't just give her the documentation. The whistleblower gave documentation to others as well.
Multiple media outlets.
So there are actually multiple opportunities for the authorities to find out who this whistleblower was. And so the suggestion from the mainstream press, who missed their opportunity to cover the story because they wouldn't cover it, their criticism of her is totally unverifiable, because there were many channels by which this guy could have been identified.
Yeah, no, it's completely unwarranted. And most likely, the most likely point where this whistleblower was identified would have been an internal search to see who, for instance, who logged in to the system to access which documents regarding arms shipments. Okay, so what they're saying in the Serbian press is interesting. It's the last thing I'll say, is they said because she mentioned the name of the arms manufacturer in Serbia, that gave away the whistleblower, which is kind of ridiculous because it's on the documents. Of course, it's from that manufacturer. She was communicating anonymously, so she wouldn't have known who he worked for.
Yes,
quite frankly. So it's interesting how these attacks are trying to discredit the journalist and discredit the whistleblower. This is how the press, for the most part, is treating this story so far. But when the clock runs out on this narrative, they're going to have to face the government corruption story eventually. So we'll see if that happens next week.
Yes. Okay. Well, look, we're right out of time. Thanks very much. Brian, have you got any closing thoughts on this or anything else that we've covered?
Well, all I'd say is that last article, the last discussion there, we see this, don't we, time and time again, that the true facts, whether it's rendition, flights, torture, arms sales, the moment the truth starts to come to the surface, there's a rapid attack on the people doing that, and particularly for alternative media. So what a very brave lady to actually stand out there and get that story out. She not only needs support from inside the country, she needs it from overseas as well.
Absolutely. Okay, thank you very much, Brian. Thank you, Patrick, for joining us today. Thank you for joining us today. We'll be back at the same time at 1 p.m. as usual on Friday. And I believe David Scott will be joining us from far afield. We shall look forward to that. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.